Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And welcome to What's Next. We're going to be talking with Tim Chen. Tim is the Executive Director of Grassroots Gardens Western New York, a return guest to What's Next. Glad to have you back, Tim.
Glad to be here. I think it's been about a year since
about a year. Yeah. But I guess maybe for a grassroots garden, maybe it's better to have you a little more toward the fall than maybe spring and summer.
Spring is a tough time for us to make. You know, we're just running all over the place.
Yeah.
With our big network.
How did it go this year? Do you see an increase in enthusiasm and interest?
There's a lot of exciting stuff going on. There's also challenges, as I think if you talk to any nonprofit, not just in Western New York, but across the U.S., they would point out. But there are exciting things, for sure. This year, we were fortunate to get support from the Buffalo Bills Foundation to really expand our school garden program. So we were able to add, at this point, 6 new schools to our network. So we're at 35 schools this year.
In the city?
So Buffalo, Niagara Falls, and now a couple schools in Kenmore.
Okay.
And that's really exciting. I think, you know, there's a lot of possibility with working with youth. Of course, that anybody who works in youth education and experiential education would tell you. And that support really helped us both offer support to more schools. The typical, you know, year we might get 1 to 2 new schools. This year we added 6. And then we also offered more programs. We offered more support for teachers to kind of go into their classrooms and help with guiding some of these lessons. Because teachers are awesome and they do great work and they also are very busy, right?
Yeah,
so sometimes
sure.
You can't expect them to do their own research and learn this whole topic of gardening on top of what they're already teaching. And for us to be able to have a little bit more support, have additional kind of staff members to help with that programming has been huge.
So when you go into a school, it's got to be pretty much starting from scratch, right?
Depends on the school,
okay.
Right? And sometimes a teacher will come to us and say, hey, I have a ton of experience with this, but I just need help getting this place started. I need some material support. I need you to come in and help me facilitate with my, for example, high school students to build these raised beds and fill them with soil. And that's something we do. And sometimes people come to us, teachers or administrators come to us and say, we want more opportunities for learning for our children. And we don't know how to do that, right? So we start from scratch then. We come in, still build the space, but we'll offer training. We'll offer kind of program modeling so teachers can observe how we do it. And often they watch us a couple of times. They're like, seed starting isn't that complicated. I have it, right? I can work with my 5th graders or 3rd graders to figure it out. And if I have questions, I'll call you.
Okay.
So it's
All
a
right.
mix.
So you're seeing, and how do kids take to it?
You know, that's a good question for our staff. I don't, unfortunately, get as many opportunities to be out teaching lessons. My
Does it
background,
seem satisfying, though, for...
Yeah, I mean, you know, just we have so many photos that we can't necessarily share because of privacy concerns.
Of
but,
course.
Smiling kids who are just so eager to do something with their hands, right? I mean, we all know that just sitting in a classroom at a desk is, for the average child, not necessarily the full range of learning being given to them. So having something where they can literally get their hands dirty, something where they can come back in the fall and like pick a cherry tomato or a snap pea from something growing in their school, that's really exciting, right? And then I think something we've done a little bit more is adding some indoor growing spaces, right? Grow lights, heating mats, grow towers to make sure that opportunity to engage in these lessons is extended through the winter season, which is very long in Buffalo, as everybody knows.
Yes, no doubt about that. It's interesting, as you were just talking, and we had a pretty wide-ranging conversation last year, but I don't think I asked you this. How about for you? When did you first get your hands dirty, so to speak? Do you have a recollection of that?
My first job, actually, after college, I ended up in Buffalo, graduated in 2009. So the job market was suspect, if you will, at that time.
Sure, absolutely.
And I ended up doing an AmeriCorps job, helping with a black club on the west side of Buffalo with a community garden. And I won't say it was a thriving space necessarily. It was a project that I think was started by folks before me and had struggled a little bit, you know, due to resident turnovers and so on and so forth. So my job was to try to re-engage. And that was really when I started my, you know, personal kind of interest in growing things. My background is in biology, so I was always interested in living things and ecosystems, but I hadn't really taken that step of trying to grow things, and that was where I got my start.
What about you? It's interesting how you said this particular garden that you got AmeriCorps decided to send you to was kind of maybe flailing at the time. What happens with garden? I mean, not every garden is a success, or sometimes they fall on hard times. I mean, what happens? What goes on there?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's very easy to look at garden projects, especially in communities where maybe the stability of the neighborhood has changed over time, maybe decreased in a lot of cases, right? And we do, as an organization, we do have to decommission spaces once in a while. And I think for us, it's really not viewing that as a failure. It's viewing that life cycle as completed, right? I think these green spaces, gardens are often one of the few seemingly achievable projects that neighborhoods might look at when they see a vacant lot. A neighborhood will not have the capacity to say, we're going to raise, you know, a couple million dollars and build a housing, like affordable housing project, right? But they will say, hey, you know, we can maybe get a group of people together, talk to this organization, Grassroots Gardens, get some support and build a green space and grow some food. I think some gardens have great lasting power, and that's a testament to the neighborhood leaders. That's a testament to the neighborhood stability. And some gardens, after 5-7 years, or sometimes even 3 or 4 years, you know, that capacity isn't there anymore. And I think when we work with gardens like that, we try to drum up more community support. And if it doesn't work after many attempts, we'll go in, we'll clean it up. Especially city lots, the city of Buffalo and city of Niagara Falls ask us to make sure that, you know, we just clear everything off the space.
Better to clear it than
For us, it's fairly easy, right? A lot of times it's just taking out the lumber and tamping down the soil where the raised beds were. We don't like to do that, so we try to make efforts to make sure we're talking to community members, seeing if there's more engagement, seeing if there's other kind of local institutions that want to jump in and help out. But, you know, usually after 2 years of working through that process, and if there's not enough interest, we say, well, this life cycle is closed.
Okay.
And if future neighbors want to restart a garden in the space, we are always happy to engage and help that process again. And that's okay, right? Because these spaces are otherwise vacant spaces where the city might just mow it once or twice a summer. And if we can activate it for a couple of years, if it brings joy, if it brings nutritious food, if it teaches some neighbors how they can use these spaces, even in their own backyards or their front porches, then it's still worth the effort.
It's interesting, though, to talk about how the lack of support can be there, and you get to a certain point, just like you said, the life cycle ends. It's a nice way of putting it. How many people really do you think you need? I mean, I'm sure there's always that one person who's willing to do, thinking that they're willing to do it all, which probably is a recipe for a short-term failure. But what about that? What would you suggest is kind of like the standard approach, if there is such a thing?
The more, the better. I think gardening is both very easy and very challenging in that once you build the space, it's not hard to maintain it, but it's hard in the sense that you have to show up almost every day in the summer when it's 85, 90 degrees. You have to weed and water very regularly. And it does not take you 3 hours a day to do that, but you have to show up. And we know that people are stretched thin. People have, you know, multiple jobs. They have families they're taking care of. And that's not an expectation that we can just foist on someone and say, hey, you all need to do this, which is why all our projects are driven by community members. We're not going to grab a vacant lot and say, we're going to build a garden and hope people show up. We understand that that is not sustainable for most communities. Now, we do have absolutely powerhouses in community leadership sometimes.
Give me an example of a powerhouse. I like to talk about our community powerhouses.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I will say as our organization has grown and aged, we expanded our footprint from initially the Lower West Side in the mid-90s, right, to now really supporting a lot of East Side Gardens, where there's a lot of vacant lots, and there are equity concerns as far as the history of redlining, lack of homeownership, right? Neighborhoods there deserve and are getting more support from us. But it's easier sometimes to look at the old gardens and, and look at that as a model simply because there's a history there. So there are a number of Lower West Side gardens that just have community elders who have done an amazing job. But you also look at East Side gardens, especially some of the church gardens where, you know, you might have one to two people that manage a space that has 15, 20 raised beds, and they are feeding people in their church. They're donating the excess to local food pantries. And it's incredible that, you know, we provide the supplies. We might bring in a volunteer group or two during the season, but they're the folks who are doing this day to day, organizing people who show up on Saturday mornings and help water or harvest, so on and so forth.
You know, talking about grassroots gardens, I mean, there's, you know, there's a lot of images that flash, but you just reminded us really a key part of it is the food that can be harvested from it. What are the possibilities?
I mean, you know, I think we think and talk a lot about the local food system in our work right now. We have a lot of friends who, friend organizations, right? They manage urban farms. They, you know, might run youth programs that teach youth how to steward vacant lots, how to farm. And when you look at a garden, if it's just in one single vacant lot, the amount of food that's produced there will not feed the whole neighborhood.
Sure.
You might produce, say, 50, 70, maybe 100 pounds of food per raised bed per year, which is great. But, you know, that doesn't even feed one family fully from one raised bed. I think the goal really is to be a model, be an entry point for people to think about local food systems a little bit more. Realizing, all right, you know, these are the easy vegetables to plant that maybe rats and squirrels don't bother. This is a way to supplement my grocery bill, but it's also a way to learn how I can do this, maybe, like I mentioned, in my backyard, on my front porch, how I can teach my neighbors once I have some understanding, the idea of some level of food sovereignty, some level of food security, even if it's not fully covered by a community garden space. I think that resiliency it builds both in people's minds, but also those connections with neighbors is critical. Having that support network is something that I think, as all of us went through COVID, for example, some of those connections were severed as all of us were, you know, cooped up in our houses, anxious about human contact in person. And we're still getting out of that. But I think these third places that have popped up, right, for years across Western New York and continue to be really critical spaces, that's where we see a lot of this potential of relationship building and connection to the food system.
Yeah, interesting, though, you mentioned how one raised bed might produce, let's say, I know you're probably just pulling the figure out, but maybe like 100 pounds of food. How big of a raised bed would produce 100 pounds of food?
You know, our standard raised beds that we build are 4 feet by 8 feet.
It's not very big at all.
It's not very big. We don't build it wider because we want to make sure people can reach in. Like, there are dimensions, right, to consider as far as how accessible it is and how easy it is to weed down the middle. So that's the reasoning for some of the sizing and also making sure the soil pressure doesn't kind of burst the boards on the sides and they're more durable. But it depends on the crop you grow. I think certain things like leafy greens, right, it may not produce weight-wise as much as if you maybe grow a ton of tomatoes or like a high-yield tomato plant or maybe snap peas or beans, right, might produce quickly. And then you can plant something else in the bed right after you're done with that crop in the late spring. So that can all lead to different yields. That's why I say anywhere between like maybe 50 to 100 pounds is an estimate.
Sure. Tim Chen with us here, the executive director of Grassroots Gardens Western New York. Just a general question, though. Interest in this type of thing, it is on the rise?
It's very high. Last year, we finally found the capacity to build an individual volunteer program. By individual volunteer, I'm referencing people who kind of come to us on our own versus, for example, a student group or a corporate group.
Sure.
There are people who in the past we might say, hey, you know, we're going to connect you to a garden, but we as a staff team, because we're six people right now, right, and we work with 100 plus gardens across Western New York, we weren't able to consistently offer experiences and mentorship to make sure those volunteers were getting what they were looking for. So we built a program that has really been amazing. It's been a great support. We've met incredible people who just want to get their hands dirty, want to give back to the community, want to meet other people and maybe want to test out to see if they want to consistently work in a garden or if they just want to do it 3-4 times a year. Both are amazing, right? But I think sometimes people want to know a little bit what they're getting into before committing to fully joining a community garden and showing up maybe every week to help them. We've had well over 100 individual volunteers come through in the last year and a half. They've contributed over 500 hours. Wow. Between last year and this year, actually, we're coming up on probably 800-900 hours total that people have contributed to helping out. And it's just wonderful. I think it's a great way for people who just moved to Buffalo to connect to their neighborhood, to meet new people. It's a great way for people who are thinking about gardening to learn some skills. And it's a great way for people to understand a little bit more of like what gardening in public spaces means. It's not just the food aspect. It's the community aspect that I've mentioned. It's the relationship aspect. And it's learning what community leadership looks like on a very local scale.
Before we went on the air, we're having a little discussion about something that your organization has in common with my organization, Buffalo Toronto Public Media, and unfortunately, a lot of other nonprofits, and that is federal funding cuts. And, did a program with our CEO, who I thought did a very eloquent job of expressing the fact that, this is a type of pain that a lot of organizations are feeling. At the same time, it's your organization. And have these cuts come and impacted you already?
Absolutely. I think between kind of projected and revenue we were supposed to already receive, we've lost close to $100,000over the last year. And our budget, for reference, and this is public information on our tax paperwork, so our budget typically is in the $600,000 neighborhood for our organization. So that's substantial.
Huge cut, yes.
Our friends at Providence Farm Collective have been in the news a little bit. They lost even more funding for their Farming for New Americans program. I may be getting the program wrong, but they lost a big, federal grant, and they've been fighting that, yep. I think, to some level of success recently.
Yes, that is true.
But I haven't,
as of right now,
right, which is amazing, yeah, and great for them, and we hope they are able to see that through. But it's not just us, right? And we've certainly been impacted. We're short-staffed right now because we have positions that we haven't been able to fill, after a staff departure. So that just means our staff are all kind of stepping up a little bit.
As if they weren't already stepping up.
Right. And they've been incredible, to their credit. But our gardeners are also really incredible. And we want to make sure that the work that is happening right now, that's been going on for some communities over a decade or two, continues to be supported.
I'm going to ask you to kind of jump off topic a little bit here. And if you don't want to get too into this, it's fine. But you mentioned Providence Farm Collective. And we did a program with them, actually, just as that first funding cut came through. I'm going to ask you, if somebody now who sees the possibility of gardens around the Buffalo area, looking at their programs, what they do out in the Orchard Park, Boston area, there, Hamburg area, what the value of that is. I mean, I have my own thoughts about it, but I'm just kind of curious from you, who have your experience, sure, is obviously considerably different than mine.
There are plenty of people much smarter than me to talk about the food system that, if you want a list, I can give you a list later on to to invite
we'll
them on your
programs.
Show, right?
Yeah, yeah.
If you're looking for content. But to us, like I mentioned, we talk a lot about the food system, and I briefly discussed what we see as our organization identity and our place in the food system, which is the educational piece, the gateway, the entry level of realizing urban spaces can be used for cultivating food. And then you go up a little bit in scale and you see the urban farms locally, right? That we have a number of across just within city boundaries in Buffalo, less so in Niagara Falls, I think, because of significant soil contamination issues up there.
Right, right.
But in Buffalo, certainly, there is a growing urban farm scene, which is incredible. We know most, if not all, the folks who are doing that. And they're wonderful people who are doing a lot of work in their neighborhoods. And then you go out a little bit broader to a space like Providence Farm Collective, where there is clearly interest from folks, especially folks who have moved here with agricultural skills and backgrounds. And that's been a huge population that Providence Farm Collective has supported really well, evidenced by the continued interest,
right,
and folks who make that trip out there regularly to steward these spaces. A community garden plot, right? Two beds in a community garden is not sufficient for people who really want to be doing that work regularly, have the skills. and are interested in maybe engaging in the market system and in building a business around that. So there's certainly a place for that. We don't have the capacity to do right. that work, but they do, and they're doing a great job of it.
Let's turn it back then now to Grassroots Gardens, Western New York. It's now the harvest season as we talk here, but at the same time, it's, you know, winter's going to be here. We're all going to be eager to get out there. How, you know, what should somebody who's kind of intrigued by what we're talking about here, how should they maybe start moving forward as we, you know, we're in the fall and things are going, we know what's coming. We know what's coming for the soil of Western New York here over the coming months. What, though, looking ahead, what should people start thinking about here?
I mean, after the summer, this summer in particular, I feel like people might be really ready for a break. It's been, aside from the last 2 weeks or so, it's been just outrageously hot, as I think all your listeners who are local will know. So it's a nice time to, honestly, like I tell people all the time, is like, let us rest a little bit. You take some rest, right, as a gardener or a community. But we all know that starting in January, people are going to be calling us and being like, hey, you know, when are our seedling orders due? When do we get this? When are we going to plan on this? I think for folks who are really interested in maybe starting to dabble, this is actually a great time to join some events, whether it's with us, whether it's other organizations who are putting on public events. It's a great time to collect seeds, learn how to save seeds, learn how to...
Collect seeds. What do you exactly mean by collect seeds?
Well, seeds come from someplace.
That's true.
Right? They come from the plants that we grow, the vegetables that we grow. And we often don't think about that because right. when people start gardening, a lot of the initial way of entry is to go to the hardware store or local nurseries, right, to buy some seedlings,
right.
the little plants that come in the little pots with some soil and then pop them in the ground or in buckets when you get home. But any fruit, any vegetable, the seed, any flower, those seeds can be collected typically around this time of the year. So that's a skill that some people are very, very interested in doing that can help you preserve some of the genetics of certain plants that have done really well in the particular environment you're growing in. And it's just depending on what kind of plant it is, right? There are different ways to harvest. Sometimes you have to leave a vegetable on the plant until it's completely rotted. And then you go in and pick the seeds out and keep them in a dry place until you plant them the next season. So there's a lot of learning opportunities, even as the harvest season comes to, well, a start, I guess, but as winter comes upon us. And then, you know, for our communities, really, we just had a community meeting with a garden on the Lower West Side last night. And it's a time where we're looking at some of these transitions we talked about earlier, right? What does the support for this garden look like? And how do we engage new people? That's something that we've been working a lot on to try to make sure if there are garden leaders who are sometimes in their 80s, right, and saying, we want to take a step back right now, we want to cultivate new leadership. That's something that we do a lot of work in through the winter to reach out to people to do some planning meetings and build some capacity in communities, make sure people have the skills, feel some confidence, and know what we can provide to support them in the next growing season. So, you know, if you're someone who wants to go beyond growing in your own backyard and organizing your community members, it's a great time to reach out before the snow hits, get contact information, and build some of these connections to share resources, be in contact to prepare for next spring.
And the best way to get a hold?
Oh, well, people can reach out to us, of course. And I think a lot of our gardens just really started with neighbors knocking on neighbors' doors and talking about what they see as particular needs in their neighborhood. Going to a block club meeting. If there isn't a block club, maybe trying to start one. I think it's really critical in the face of a kind of the broad level larger scale challenges that you mentioned as far as nonprofits, kind of the federal policies that's impacting all of us and trickling down to even affect state funding, for example. It's important for us to continue realizing that we can wait for those things to hopefully get fixed. And there's also other things that we should be and can be doing in the meantime. Those are actions that I think really drove the formation of Grassroots Gardens 30 years ago. Is people saying, well, nobody's coming to help this space, right?
Right.
So if we don't do it, nobody will. So we're going to do it. That philosophy, that vision is still true. Even if it feels like sometimes it's harder to organize, even if it feels like the internet has kind of replaced a lot of those social connections, I'd encourage folks, anybody listening to this, it doesn't need to be around gardens, right? But talk to your neighbors, get to know them, and figure out where you as a community want to get organized. I think that's one of the biggest pieces that I've continued to learn from our garden leaders that have been around for 20, 30 years.
Well, Tim Chen, always a great conversation. Maybe come back in the spring and get us ready.
call me after June, I think. That might be a little better schedule for me.
All right, very good. Tim Chen is the Executive Director of Grassroots Gardens, Western New York. Tim, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
When we come back, more from What's Next from Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Whether you're here for the headlines, the harmonies, or the next great song, you're in the right place. We've brought all our stations together under one name, Buffalo Toronto Public Media, BTPM NPR, BTPM Classical, BTPM The Bridge, BTPM PBS. Unique voices, one connected home for public media. New name, same great content. Discover more at btpm.org.
At Buffalo Toronto Public Media, we're committed to serving our entire community. Whether you're listening to investigative journalism on BTPM NPR, enjoying world-class performances on BTPM Classical, discovering new local artists on BTPM The Bridge, or immersing yourself in mysteries on BTPM PBS, public media has something for everyone. Explore programs that matter to you at btpm.org. This is public media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues facing the communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern we should be addressing? Email us at whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that matter. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Back on What's Next, I'm Jay Moran here on Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR, and we welcome back from Niagara Pride, Dr. Ron Piacesny, the Executive Director, Sherry Fawcett, the Co-Executive Director and also Programming Chair. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us again.
Great to have you back. You had you here not too long ago to talk about the fifth anniversary event. 5 years of Niagara Pride. Sherry, you weren't there at the very beginning.
No, I was not.
Ron, you were there.
I was.
Can you reflect what you thought would happen? What was the goal when this all started?
So would you like to know our origin story?
I want to hear the origin story. I love origin stories.
It's like a Marvel Universe cinematic kind of thing.
All I know is people go to all the Marvel movies.
Exactly.
So we've got some compelling content here.
Exactly. I wish it was that super exciting. No, actually, it started off many, many years ago. In Niagara Falls, there was a small social meetup group that was meeting on a regular basis, LGBTQ folks who recognized the fact that they felt kind of isolated. They wanted something that they could feel comfortable and have some time with one another just to drink coffee, play board games, all that kind of stuff. Over a couple of years, they realized that people were coming into the group that were maybe saying, I need a referral for medical, or I don't know where to go for this, or I don't know where to go for these particular services. And so it started to exceed what this kind of loose gathering of people kind of knew where to refer folks to. So they reached out to a wonderful agency, the Pride Center of Western New York. They reached out to them. And at the time, I was working as a contracted out facilitator, running groups for them, doing different types of programming. And they asked me if I would be willing to go and be the group facilitator for them. So that led to the creation of something called, unfortunately, not super original based on our name, but Niagara County Pride.
Okay.
And so we operated that way for a good number of years, actually, where I was the facilitator for that. And that's really where we started seeing things taking off, where we started creating things like a health fair, bringing in other providers and agencies to talk about their services, to get folks to know what is in their backyard, who is affirming, what providers are doing what. We also brought in presenters from the EEOC to talk about employment discrimination and lawyers. And basically, I was pulling from my vast background and job experience, just getting people to come in and really provide more than just what we were doing, which was the coffee meetup, really kind of expanding on that. Unfortunately, over time, as we grew and started developing more and more of these kinds of programs within Niagara County, budgets are always tight with nonprofits. And the time came for there to be a decision and a discussion about, well, what is the next step for that group. I thought that there was going to be more secure funding 5 years ago. Mm. Unfortunately, that was not the case. And so a lot of things had to get pulled back. And so we had to make a decision as a group in Niagara Falls. Does this revert back to just a social meetup group, which meets the guidelines and prescriptions of what they had in mind and what they could perform versus what the express needs were of the community? And with my husband and a handful of other people, we decided that we were going to take a stab at, let's create our own agency. Let's figure out how we can continue providing what the community is saying that they need and has been working incredibly well up to that point. How do we continue that and have a different mission from some of the other Pride organizations that were around? So that, again, we wouldn't have that those same constraints, right, that we could really do what the community was asking for. So as I always joke, you've probably heard this one-liner before, but the best time to start a nonprofit that relies on social meetups and people coming together is during a global pandemic.
Of course.
Why not? Yes, like, right, at the right height of the COVID pandemic.
That's right,
pandemic.
5 years ago, right, right.
Exactly. So we're all in our houses and
trapped.
Trapped. And here we are. We're like, we're going to branch out. We start the paperwork, all the process to become a nonprofit. We pivoted, again, relying on the technology of the time, converting things to virtual meetups and having those exact same things that I talked about, those health fairs and those providers, but now doing it within a virtual realm and making sure that our folks could access that and still have their needs of socialization and friendship still being met. And then as restrictions lifted, we began just going back to what we knew of running in-person programs, in-person festivals and services. And 5 years later, which I know doesn't seem like a long time, it's 5 years is a very short period of time, but we've grown to the point where we now have in-house programming, 4 different Pride festivals. We're the agency that hosts the 5K for all of Western New York. We offer grants and scholarships and our 2 newest drop-ins, which have just amazed me that we've been able to implement them. We're so happy that we got them started. Our youth drop-in program and our senior drop-in program.
Which is fabulous.
Yeah. Okay.
I love my seniors.
Really?
Oh,
what do you see? What do you hear?
They came in like gangbusters the first day. We had donations from the community bringing in art supplies, paints, snacks, drinks. All these things were donated. We had a site on Amazon. Is it still up?
Yep. People can still donate.
People can donate to us. The different things, our wish list, and all these things were sent to the office. And the first time we had our drop-in, they were paintings and drawings and they were talking and it was just beyond my dreams. We had 9 seniors drop in.
On the first day.
On the first time out.
Which I think, and this is something that we've been talking about as an agency, as well as other agencies, we've noticed that sometimes we say numbers like, well, 9 people showed up and folks may think, well, that's not really a lot. For 9 people who across Niagara County, again, being a very rural county, sometimes often referred to as a provider desert or service desert, sure, in a lot of ways, to have folks drive in from Lockport, drive in from North Tonawanda, couple folks from Erie County to basically come in and say, on this day, I really needed to be with other LGBTQ folks. I needed that socialization. I needed to talk about, and they've brought up some heavy issues.
Yes.
Right, yeah. And, you know, I wanted to maybe get into that just a little bit because, you know, I think in past conversations we've had you here, kind of not necessarily just focused exclusively on youth, but most certainly the unique issues facing young people when it comes to this. But if you're a senior, how the world has changed for somebody since they were very young to now. So I guess I'm wondering if you can share some of the conversations you hear, because, you know, there was marriage wasn't something that was accessible. It was, you know, there were all sorts of things. I mean, a lot of people lived, you know, as quietly and in the shadows as they could, I guess.
Yeah.
Yep. So I'm wondering maybe what you hear when the senior drop-ins.
Want me to tackle this one?
Yeah. Oh,
sure.
Sure. I'll jump in because, you know, I've got my little pieces too.
So one of the biggest things that we kept hearing, even before we started the senior drop-in at our different events that we took to heart and why we created the center or the drop-in, the primary thing that LGBTQ folks here in Niagara County have been referencing is the fact that there is a fear, grounded in reality or not, or even personal experience, whether this happened, there is a driving fear and concern that right now we are at a point within America that should an LGBTQ person present to a provider, that they may not be accepted. We have actually some stories, people have come and told us that their pronouns have not been respected, that they have come in, they are trans elders, they will go into a provider here locally, and the staff of that provider has actually referred to them by their dead name. And not that they have been denied service, that, again, not that we've heard
denied
that.
Denied respect,
but
would that be the right way of saying it?
Denied respect, yes. Denied, yeah, that level of being able to be out and open. And so there are these levels of concern that do mirror some of the national trends that we're seeing, where folks are saying that if they go to some of their providers, that if you look at nursing facilities or long-term care facilities, even if the staff has undergone diversity training and they may have safe space stickers in, let's say, the staff offices, if you go to the common areas, if you go to some of the places within that facility, you will predominantly find programming on the television that may have a non-LGBTQ affirming bias to it or the stories that are presented there. So if you think about that, if you're a resident of a facility, that is your home now. And if you are surrounded by other residents who are your neighbors, and that is all that is on TV, or that's all that's presented, or the programming doesn't, like the activities don't include or aren't inclusive, you start to feel marginalized even more. So that has been one of the main concerns, is that folks that are seniors and elders, they want to have those safe spaces because, again, even slight experiences like that resonate so much more if you are older, don't have the same level of support network that you had before, you're not as active, you're not going to activities, pride festivals, you're not out there as often. And so when you do go out there, you want to have affirming experiences to validate your existence and to feel safe and comfortable. And so that's why we, again, created our senior program to be able to afford that to folks in Niagara County.
And they do feel safe and they do have fun.
Yeah.
And it's like they almost don't want to leave.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, based on the experiences that Ron was just talking about, I can most certainly appreciate that.
As soon as they come through the door, they know they're welcomed.
Yeah.
And feel free to do whatever they need to do. And they truly do enjoy themselves.
And, just, you know, your office started, you just opened up your office, I think, in the last...
April. So it's been...
3 months, 4 months?
Since April. What is that? 5, 6 months?
5, 6 months. Oh,
I'm
wow.
I'm bad with math.
I'm bad with math, too.
So I went into mental health and law. I didn't have to look.
Really, numbers aren't my thing.
Exactly.
Yes, we did move. And it, once again, that was... an adventure for Ronald and I, but a proud adventure. We're located now, it is very accessible to all of
people of differing abilities.
Disabilities.
Downtown Niagara Falls, right?
Yes, 1522 Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, so and it's been a success in terms of these drop-ins.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes, we have a room off of our office space for a little bit more of an intimate group. But if we have a larger group, there's a conference room that we can go in and do our artwork or whatever. We can also show movies up in the front conference room if we want to. It's just, it's a very nice facility for us.
Are the drop-ins monthly or?
So they are once a month. Okay. So we do our senior drop-in is the first Friday of every month in the morning, starting 9 a.m. to 1 p.m.
And a little longer if need be.
If need be. Exactly.
I can't imagine.
Exactly. Our second Friday of the month is our youth drop-ins. So that is, we've had that now our second time.
This is our second time.
Yep.
Actually, today, when we leave here, we're going to our youth drop-in.
Oh, okay. Yep. Very good.
And so that's, let's see here. So that's the second Friday of every month. And then some of the other things that we've done is in-house legal clinics. Mm-hmm. We've partnered with UB Law. Their students come and they do a couple of legal things, name changes, help with passport applications, gender markers to get those done. And we're in the process of working with another nonprofit to offer more expansive legal clinical services so that if somebody needed help with their public benefits or public assistance, housing, discrimination, they'd be able to come in and access that as well. And I do want to just also say, I know we talk a lot about LGBTQ and that is the focus of our agency, but we are open to allies as well. So anybody, we want to put that message out there that if you are an ally and you need any of our services, please come. Don't feel that this is just exclusive for LGBTQ. I always say we're part of the fabric of the community, so we're open to everybody.
We're talking with two members of Niagara Pride, Dr. Ron Piacesny, the executive director, Sherry Fawcett, co-executive director, and programming chair. Both volunteers, right?
Yes.
Yeah, something to keep in mind. When we talk about all these different things here, it really is amazing the amount, really the depth of all of the things that you guys do. And I kind of want to get into that just a little bit here, because I think we had you back here earlier in the summer. A lot of events were going on or ready to happen. So you host four Pride festivals in Niagara County.
Correct. Yes.
Including in Newfane.
Yes.
Yes.
And your volunteers.
Yes.
Are you questioning our sanity, Jay? Is that what's happening here?
Well,
I think we question our sanity.
We question it daily.
Sure, exactly. Sure. So how does that go? I mean, obviously you wouldn't be doing it if there wasn't a need and if you weren't getting response.
It's been a slow progression, although again, 5 years does not seem like a slow progression. That's like pretty rapid growth.
Right.
No, we have had, again, amazing response from the community where we started off with a virtual 5K, which kicks off Pride season here in Western New York. Mm-hmm. Again, because of the COVID protocols that happened when we first started. And as those were lifted, we were able to start doing more and more in person. So that has really taken off. We talked a little bit off air about how we grew from last year having 44 participants that were runners, walkers in the 5K to this year at our 5K, we had 118 participants, over 50 vendors. It was just an amazing turnout.
Fabulous day. It was from the minute I got to the venue, which is SUNY Niagara. It was just a day between the law enforcement there, very helpful. Mm-hmm. The whole campus, everybody's always very helpful. The maintenance staff, everybody helping us set up our rainbow arch, which is a story in itself I won't get into.
Okay.
You know, and getting the vendors in there and having, we have Wegmans come in and do they donate?
Yep, and they
Wegmans donates the food to us, and they cook it, and they serve it for after the race. And then we had like few performances after the race, and it was a day.
Yeah,
it was a beautiful day, and we have beautiful medals for the first top three runners that come in.
And then just expanding into the other four cities, so doing a Pride festival each weekend. Again, with our mission in mind that we recognize being a rural community mm-hmm. and a rural county, we sometimes don't have the same luxury that Erie County and Buffalo has. There are some amazing pride organizations that do incredible work here, mm-hmm. and they are super accessible by folks in Buffalo and the surrounding suburbs. You don't have that same level of transportation, that right. same level of ability or financial resources. So for us, it was mission critical, as I always say, to ensure that if we're going to carry on some type of pride celebration or festival and making sure people feel seen and respected in their communities, we have to bring it to that community. So that is what kind of started the whole thing with Newfane Pride and Lockport Pride and North Tonawanda, partnering with our friends there at Oliver Street Merchant. Mm-hmm. And of course, without Old Falls Street Corporation helping us in Niagara Falls, we've been able to grow Niagara Falls' Pride, which is known as Rainbow City Pride.
It's so interesting to hear about the growth. And I almost hate to put you on the spot about this, but what's next? What's next for Niagara Pride? I mean, you must have pride. I got a feeling this is something that's, I'm not catching you off guard in terms of this conversation.
No. There's some of the things that we have looked at that we may not necessarily yet have an idea how we're going to achieve it, but we have discussed it.
Right. It's been in the talks.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
Transportation continues to be an obstacle for individuals
major
within
issue.
Niagara County. Mm-hmm. And so that is one of the things that our strategic plan is looking at, is how do we maybe address getting folks to be able to come to our events or getting them to different programs and services. And so that's going to be really the next obstacle that we want to tackle, whether that is we have some sort of vehicle that we're able to do that in-house.
A minibus or mm-hmm. something.
Okay.
Exactly. Or we utilize other services, partner with them to be able to provide some sort of transportation. But that's one of the big key issues right there is mm-hmm. tackling that. And then I think with a lot of stuff that we're seeing, again, on the national level, some of our biggest concerns is that we feel like we're going to see probably more legal challenges. And so the partnerships that we're developing right now with UB Law, and I think I can say their name, we're working on it. It's a very great organization, whatever it looks like, our partnership, but Neighborhood Legal Services, they do so many amazing things. And so we want to make sure that folks who may be seeing potential legal obstacles for whatever transgender issues, housing issues, any types of
anything.
Discrimination, that they have places that they know where they can go to access legal advice and be able to get the relief that they need and seek that. So we want to ensure that that's the other piece that we're providing and moving forward.
This just all popped in my head. I'm wondering if you've encountered this here at Public Media. We will certainly have let everybody know that Public Media has been defunded on the federal level. One thing that has been really startling that we have found through some of our folks who are working with government officials, people who are elected officials, that some of them really didn't have a full understanding of the impact of some of the things that they were supporting, including the fact that public media stations might be losing their funding. Some might have to go off the air. I'm wondering if that's something that you're also maybe seeing, that there are people who are supporting a certain agenda that they think is right for whatever reason, but then is maybe having a negative impact on your community. I'm just wondering if those are issues that are coming up as well. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes there's a simplification of making issues and building political power, and then some people don't understand the ramifications.
So I think that's a great point. And on a multitude of levels, I think we are seeing folks talking about it and being impacted or soon to be impacted. So, for example, we know that with part of the budget that has been passed going forward, a lot of social service programs are going to be cut nationally, mm-hmm. and that's going to impact state budgets as to what they can provide and not provide. The LGBTQ community, typically, if you look at all of the statistics that have been gathered by Gallup and other economic-based research companies, LGBTQ people still to this day continue to experience employment discrimination, not just in terms of not getting hired or being fired, but also being paid less on the national level. We see that, especially if you are LGBTQ and another minority, so let's say a person of color, if you are female and LGBTQ, you're still then experiencing those same barriers that, say, a cisgendered white woman would experience or Black woman. So we're still seeing that that is impacting our community. Trans individuals get significantly less pay than their non-transgender counterparts. And so when we start talking about the loss of benefits across the board, like SNAP or food stamps or other types of assistance, the cost of healthcare and losing those kinds of subsidies and then people not being able to access healthcare, it may not necessarily read as this is an LGBTQ issue or this is a Black issue or a Hispanic issue, but it will impact marginalized communities who are already struggling financially, that are on the lower socioeconomic end. And so I think that's where, to your point, folks maybe just don't yet see how that impacts. We talk about maybe X over here being what we're trying to target, right, maybe politically, but the ramifications of that impact everyone.
Mm. And then just a final question to you, Sherry, in this sense of, You weren't there at the start of Niagara Pride. What brought you in, and what have you? What keeps you going?
What brought me in?
Yeah.
Wow. We can leave the story about my husband out of. But the how about the mission? Did you like the mission at least?
Well, just leaving his husband out of it. I bowl on Buffalo Historical Bowling League, which is here in Western New York. And Ronald and his husband and a few other people came to the league and saw me. I'm the vice president of the league and also their programming person there. So I'm running around selling 50-50. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. And then one night I'm running around trying to get out of there so I can go home. Ronald comes up to me. Hey, would you like to be on the board of Niagara Pride? And I'm so busy. I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever.
Always get them when they're distracted. That's the key.
So I'm going to write that one down.
I'm moving on. A couple days later, Ronald comes up to me and tells me, oh, I need your resume, your firstborn, and I need all of these things by tomorrow.
In triplicate paperwork.
And I'm like, okay, what did I get myself into? So I get it all put together. I hand it to him. And I think that's going to be it. Oh, no. I have an interview.
Mm-hmm. Wow. For a volunteer spot.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Which, let me jump in.
Go ahead.
It's because of the nature of the work we do. We want to make sure that the folks that we bring on board, that they have a good sense of the community. Could we take what we do very serious?
Of course.
Because we impact so many lives.
Yeah.
So
you passed the interview.
I passed the interview, welcome to Niagara Pride. And I haven't stopped. The next thing I know, Ronald knew about my skills in programming and doing different event things and everything. So the next thing I know, he slowly sneaks it in. Mm-hmm. And the next thing I know, I'm the programming chair. I'm shadowing Ronald the first year, going around. I'm like, oh, this is fun. And it was great. The next year, I still shadowed him a little bit. And then this year, Ronald comes up to me and he goes, I'm going back to school.
Yep.
And I'm getting this licensure I need so we can do our drop-ins and everything. You're running Niagara Pride.
You're the keys.
Wow.
You're running Niagara Pride. And I'm like, okay. And.
But I had full faith. The rest of the board also had full faith in your abilities. And so.
And without Ronald, I attended all the meetings. Newfane Pride. I talked with all the people. It was all me talking to everybody. And everything went off. It was a success. Newfane, I will say, was my proudest one. Newfane, it's very rural.
Sure. Oh, no doubt.
All my vendors were set up. It was going off. The youth there were so happy and so proud. They were wearing their pride flags. They were standing along the street, waving at cars and cheering. it literally brought me to tears. Mm. They were just so proud to be there. And I'm like, I'm standing there going, yep, yep, Ronald, we are going to keep doing this and there's no stopping me. There is no stopping me at all.
Maybe you won't come out of your hiatus, huh, Ron? I'll just give him the keys. Don't take the keys back.
Exactly.
Oh, they're already planted in his car.
If someone wants to find out more about Niagara Pride, what can they do?
www.niagarapride.org. We are on Facebook. Our handle is Niagara Pride, parentheses, serving all of Western New York. And we're on Instagram at Niagara_Pride. Or you can email us at info@niagarapride.org.
Well, always a pleasure to have you here on What's Next. Sherry Fawcett, Ron Piacenza, thanks very much for being with us on What's Next.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.